another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. I'm Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zampro, naturopathic physician and herbalist, and I'm real happy to join you on so we could talk about health, wellness, and alternative medicine today. And you can always get more information about our activities at naturalnurse.com or Dr. Z Naturally. That's drznaturally.com. We have a guest today, one of my colleagues and friends and mentees, I guess. Dr. Lindsay Jamalski is a licensed naturopathic doctor, acupuncturist, and CEO of Hawthorne Holistic Health, which is a family natural medicine practice in Hamden, Connecticut. And she attended the University of Bridgeport for her doctorate in naturopathic medicine and her master's of science in acupuncture. And she was greatly influenced by many healers, and throughout her education, she developed a strong mentorship with myself and participated in many of my Eco Tours for Cures ethnobotany trips to Jamaica. And she became enamored with the Jamaican people, culture, and the use of plant medicines, and she actually wrote her thesis on some of these plant medicines and now participates on the trip as teaching faculty. And, of course, she has a very strong knowledge, and she's also a professional herbalist with the American Herbalist Guild as well and an adjunct faculty where she teaches botanical medicine and the core botanical medicine classes. And she is committed to making sure that the naturopathic physicians of the future are not UPS herbalists. And I'm so happy to have her on. Welcome.
Hi, Dr. C. Thank you.
Great. What's a UPS herbalist, Lindsay?
UPS herbalist is somebody who thinks that herbs come from the box, from the UPS man, instead of, you know, whatever tree or plant or root they really come from.
Why do you think that's a problem, that people are disconnected with nature? And not just some holistic doctors who don't even realize that, you know, herbs or plants, but people too. What's your feelings on that?
Well, on the one hand, the one problem is that it turns into kind of this separate medicine, and a lot of times then you're worrying about plant medicines that are single extracts, and they might not be, you know, as beneficial as using a plant in the whole form. And it also just disconnects you from the plant and how it works. A lot of times we learn about plants, you know, their vitality and how they grow and what they look like. And so if you're disconnected from that, you don't get the full benefit, I don't think, of the plant.
Yeah, I agree. So why did you decide to go into, like, naturopathic and holistic kind of medicine? I know you had some kind of a background in social science as an undergrad. What was your allure?
Yeah, so I always wanted to do something working with people. My mom's a social worker and does counseling, and she always loved her clients and, you know, enjoyed the difference in every day and how people will always surprise you and fascinate you. And so I always loved that. I wanted to go into psychology because of that. I got my undergraduate in human development and family studies, and then I started working at a psych hospital, and it just was not a good fit. You know, I was working on a kids' unit, 3 to 8 year olds who are just being, you know, fed a ton of sugar at lunch and then given Thorazine when they're overacting and hyper after. And it just, there wasn't enough counseling, there wasn't enough skills being taught, and it just wasn't what I wanted to do. And that same summer, an article in our local paper about a naturopath was there. My mom showed it to us, and it just kind of clicked.
Tell me about your training as a naturopathic physician for those listeners joining us that may have no idea what we're talking about. We kind of live in a bubble within our profession, but yet we're still pioneers in getting the word out as to what naturopathic medicine, or naturopathic medicine, if you pronounce it that way, is.
Yeah, so as I said, my undergraduate was in more of a social science, so I had to squeeze in all my extra medical anatomy, physiology, all those core science courses as my prerequisites, because to get into a naturopathic program, it is a, you know, postgraduate program. You need to have all your medical sciences, all those prerequisites. So that was the first step. And then once you get into the program, you know, there's a few schools in the country. It's still a very small profession. You know, it's growing, and we're getting more and more recognition and more rights, but it is only licensed from state to state, naturopathic physicians. So the scope can be a little bit different, and there's not as many schools. A lot of the schools are out on the West Coast as well. So Bridgeport is one of the only ones, at least here in America, on the East Coast, Chicago, and then there's some in Canada. So once you're in school, you know, it's 4 years of school. First 2 years are more in your heavy sciences, again, more anatomy, physiology, full cadaver lab, biochemistry, pathology, and then you also start to get some of the natural medicine therapy. So things like hydrotherapy, botanical medicine, nutrition, you're taught more of those alternative and natural treatment methods. And then in the last 2 years, you're also doing clinicals. So there's a clinic at the school, there's off-site shifts that the students will rotate through, and then you also have to preceptor, which is observing in a naturopathic doctor's office for a certain amount of hours before you can graduate.
Then right, and then you have to pass very rigorous national boards. It's not like you can just start practicing. You really have to, do that next step, right?
Yep. And then the other thing is that because it is a smaller profession, a lot of our students are either making their own practice right out the gate, which can be a very difficult thing to do, or they're joining other practices. There's more and more residencies, again, as the profession grows, being developed, but the funding isn't there as much as for other medical programs, so it can be limited, too, to get the residencies. But the residencies are pretty competitive, and more students are able to do that now, so that's something that's growing as well.
And then you have a real interest in Chinese medicine, too. We'll eventually get into Jamaican stuff, Caribbean medicine. But it's interesting that Chinese medicine is a fascinating field in of itself.
Yeah, definitely. And I didn't think I was going to do, the second program, the acupuncture program, but then in our first year of naturopathic school, you get an introductory course to the Chinese medicine and the theories. And then one day towards the end of the semester, we get to play with the needles a little bit and practice needling a classmate. And when I did that the first time, I was like, oh, there go my nights and weekends. I guess I'm doing the second program. So, it was just kind of something that I felt like I had to do once I started to learn about it. And it's a huge core part of my practice now.
Yeah, acupuncture is important. And, of course, in China, as well as all around the world, they use herbal medicine. And that's what, of course, allured me into the whole profession and my connection with Jamaica and studying with a shaman down there, the late Lloyd Jamba Scott. And so tell me how you started to study the plants of the West Indies and what was the thing that kind of hooked you?
So our first year of the program, you had introduced it or kind of briefly mentioned the trip that you went down there, showed a few pictures, and I just kind of knew I wanted to go. And you go down and it's just stepping to another world. You've been going there for so many years on your ecotourist trips. We go up to St. Mary's in Jamaica area, and you can just tell that you just feel at home as soon as you're there. Even the first year I went, because of everybody, how much they respect you, and you've developed this core relationship with this community, everybody just feels so welcomed, and the knowledge you get is so much, at a deeper level than what you would at some sort of like touristy location or if you didn't know the people. Even if you try to make those relationships, you can tell that you've just built that for years. So that was one thing that it just felt like you were, you got to kind of skip building that whole foundation and just benefit from all the work that you had done there. And the people were just so inviting and kind, and just the idea that you can just be going for a hike and say that you're a little bit hungry and one of the Rastas is up a tree getting you like this rare exotic Ethiopian apple that tastes like roses, and then you're walking and you get a coconut and get to wash your heart with coconut water, and it was just so enriching and so interconnected with the plant medicines.
Yeah.
I just wanted to keep going back for more.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened to me, and I ended up kind of apprenticing down there for many years. Every opportunity I could get, I could go down there and study and immerse myself. What did you think was interesting about tropical medicine and how, like, listeners out there could benefit from some of these discoveries, so to speak. Because some of them, it's pretty interesting, are used in Western culture, and some of them have become drugs, you know, like major discoveries came from the rainforest. So it's that's what allures me. What allures you to it?
Yeah, I think it's that the power that it's kind of for everything. You can know the best plant to put on, you know, your mosquito bite. That'll make it itch a little bit less, something that might be a minor complaint. But then you can also know what plants really have the power to maybe fight cancer cell lines and not harm the body's own innate cells and do these more powerful, complex mechanisms as well. And then you see more and more the research now is proving these methodologies that the ancient healers and the healers in these communities have been using for these same ailments for so long. And that's what's always interesting, too, when you compare any different culture and you see these rainforest medicines used by different cultures who weren't talking to each other for the same things, like Chinese medicine and Jamaican medicine and Indian medicine and you know, Native American medicine. All these different medicines will use these same plants in the same way, and that can be really amazing too. So kind of the whole power of the plant, that it can be for the more benign little complaints and day-to-day stuff, and then it can be this more powerful, real potent medicines.
Now, within the culture that you experienced when you were in Jamaica, I guess you may not have been exposed to that in America, but what did you find that was fascinating about their use of plants as medicine?
So it's just such a part of the culture there. You know, it's a part of the mainstream media. You see it referenced constantly in, like, the pop songs or the reggae songs, right? All of the artists will reference it, from the old artists, all the old Marleys, to the new generations of Marleys, or Protégé and Chronix have a lot of songs referencing the herbs. And it's just something that most people on the street have some knowledge of these herbs. You know, when you go to the airport there, they've got 10 different Caribbean Dreams unique teas probably that you can get at the airport. If you went to the airport for America, it's like coffee and black tea and Lipton and things that are processed. It's not these unique special medicines. So you just see kind of the pride that Jamaica has in its herbs and how it is still revered, you know. So that's one thing. And then just using it at kind of every meal in a different way, whether it's cooking with different herbal influences, or they'll use tonics at almost every meal. They might have fermented bitters before a meal to stimulate their digestion, or they'll have a build-up tonic after dinner if they're looking for energy, and that's something that's sold at every bar. You know, the bar will have three things. It'll have Guinness, it'll have a build-up tonic, and it might have some, you know, red wine or something, and that's it. But that's all they need there. It's such a part of the culture.
So when you were there, you experienced that, and besides learning how to identify plants, you learned how to actually start making unique things like tinctures. Explain to patients the difference between, like, how a lot of people use teas, for instance. That seems to be the universal thing around the world. I think the World Health Organization said that teas are the number one application of medicine around the world, but people use medicines in different forms and ways. What did you learn down there?
Yeah, I think in our culture, a lot of times it's always like the strongest extract has got to be the best extract, and you need it to be, you know, the most potent this or that, but sometimes that's not always the best medicine, right? Everything's poison, nothing is poison, it all depends on the dose. So if you're using things like tea, and this is the way that they classically use these medicines, I think that that's going to be a more practical and healthy, probably, application of these medicines versus doing a super potent extract that then might have some other side effects because it is too strong for maybe the liver to process or et cetera. So going back to how different cultures use these plant medicines is really important, especially when, like we were just saying, we make then drugs from these different medicines and it kind of loses track of some of its other healing aspects. You know, a lot of plants will have multiple constituents that balance them out so they're not just as harsh on the system. So that's, you know, definitely one aspect of it. And then they will make tinctures sometimes, which is an alcohol extract of herbs. They'll make fermented bitters, and they'll do a lot of teas. And with the teas, they'll also do more of like an infusion where they'll leave roots, you know, the root tonics and these really strong tonics. They'll leave them cooking over an open fire for days at a time even to get it really, really strong. And maybe every 12 hours they add another handful of the roots or stir it around or that kind of thing. But it's kind of an ongoing, you know, stove on the pot or pot on the fire, rather.
You mentioned tonics. Probably think a tonic water making a gin and tonic. What's a tonic, Dr.?
Yeah, so in Jamaica, their kind of build-up tonics are a lot of what we would call adaptogens, so herbs that work on either your cortisol response or your hormonal response. Things like ginseng are popular adaptogens that folks know about, kind of virility tonics, so meant to enhance testosterone or enhance hormones. A lot of times they do balance out for women as well. In Jamaica, there is certain plants that will have either more of a feminine energy or masculine energy in terms of which hormonal directions you want to go with some of that. But they have various root tonics that they'll use, things like sarsaparilla and strong back and damiana can all be used sometimes as these kind of tonics that will build up and give energy.
Did you find it interesting when you got back to the United States as a naturopathic physician to kind of channel this ethnic knowledge that you learned and then look at some of the science behind some of these herbs? Like, I always found it fascinating that, like, here, these folks who didn't even, many of them, finish high school, right? It just goes to show you what really what true education is really experience and learning things. And, you know, and yet they knew so much about the clinical applications of these plants. They may not have known the chemistry or whatnot, but they were very super knowledgeable. I respected that so much. What were your thoughts about that and some experiences that you may have had?
Yeah, it's wonderful and amazing when you get home and you do have a minute to look at the research, or you can research things, look at some of the studies more, and you see just these casual phrases that some of our healers down there would use, like maybe like breaks up the stones or frees up the water if we're talking about like kidney issues or prostate issues. And then you look at the plant seed palmy back that they use, which is like Phyllanthes, and it's got a ton of research that supports it doing that. And it's just really exciting. Some of the plants, you know, might not have as much research as you want or kind of, you know, are hungry to see what else is happening there, but certain ones are certainly very supported and right in line with what these our healers down there are using them for.
So what are some of the mainstream herbs that we use to grow in Jamaica? I know many of them are common spices that we experience and we may not know. Like we may bake a pumpkin pie or do something or spice up something like that, and really we're using spices from the West Indies. And then of course there are more exotic botanicals that you know, we see, like I saw, I remember seeing, it was St. Patrick's Day down there, we often go down in March, and there was a shamrock. It was a purple shamrock, which was beautiful. I think oxalis was the genus and species, and I remember pointing it out to everyone. Hey, it's St. Patrick's Day, and this oxalis is blooming, and of course that has medicinal properties as a refrigerant, something that cools the body, high vitamin C, and things like that. So, what are some of the herbs that you might use in your practice on patients that really grow, whether it's hot or cold, they're available here?
So one definitely would be ginger. You know, they do grow a good amount of ginger down there, and that's an herb that I use, you know, almost every day in my practice on one patient or another. It's just so soothing, such a good antispasmodic, so important for women with menstrual cramping. It's a great driver, so in any formula, it's going to warm up the formula and help drive it through the blood and move the formula around. So even if you're adding it in small amounts, it's a nice addition to bitters formulas. So ginger's one that I'll use all the time. Again, and that's one that I'll happily prescribe as, you know, quote-unquote, just a tea. Because, again, these teas are medicine, and that's a conversation that I have with my patients all the time, too, is, you know, telling them that this is a medicine. It's not just like a you know, acute drink you can have. It's real powerful medicine, and it should be something that's incorporated into the day. So ginger is one example of that. Turmeric as well. You know, that's kind of a big popular herb. Everybody's pretty much starting to know turmeric, great anti-inflammatory herb, antioxidant, super protective for brain health. So we'll use that a lot. Some of the kind of power foods like moringa or spirulina are from Jamaica as well, or grow in Jamaica. So you'll see those. Of course, the spices that you mentioned, like pimento, allspice, cinnamon, a lot of those will grow there too. Some succulents, aloe or agave are going to grow there, tuna cactus. Sometimes we do hair treatments with some of those. So there's a lot of kind of mainstream ones that will grow in Jamaica that will grow in other tropical areas. And then there's many that are more unique as well that have kind of cult followings or have a lot of strict rules around how you use them, things like noni or bitter melon or aki, that are some of the more unique to Jamaica plants.
Yeah, you mentioned pimento. I found it was interesting that the Jamaicans, before there was kind of refrigeration and cold areas, they would actually use pimento to preserve food, and even, believe it or not, preserving the dead when they were being waked, because the Jamaicans they usually wake people for like 9 days, you know, a long time, and particularly when in the tropical heat, things can get kind of pretty funky. So they would take a lot of the organs out and pack the body with pimento, and that would preserve the body. That's one of the stories that Jamba taught me. And also Dr. Robertson, who's one of Jamaican's foremost ethnobotanists. It's interesting. And then we also used it as a gargle to numb out our teeth and as a gum wash, as an astringent. So pimento is great. That's commonly called allspice in our culture. And then cinnamon, too. Cinnamon is something that you find all over the world. And cinnamon, of course, is a spice that we use for flavoring, but it has all kinds of medicinal characteristics. One thing that I like about cinnamon is its effect on the blood sugar. That's kind of a more unique and more modern-day look at some of the research in cinnamon, but we use it as a mover of the blood. I put it topically in liniments for bringing blood to an area that doesn't have enough blood, if we want to heal the area pretty well. And it tastes good too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's nice too that you mentioned blood sugar, and that makes me think of hibiscus or sorrel. The Jamaican sorrel that they use is also another tea that I use a lot in my practice. And that one I like because it has a great flavor, so it helps encourage my patients to be drinking these teas. It's a refrigerant, it's yummy, super high in antioxidants, good for things like blood pressure and heart disease, but it also is a good source of chromium, which is really important for blood sugar. So that combined with maybe a little bit of ginger or a pinch of cinnamon would be nice tea.
They also make wine out of that too.
Yes.
One of their holiday wines is to make the sorrel wine and flavor it with ginger. I think that was very commonly served around the holiday times. And I didn't know. It's funny because years ago I had no idea that the hibiscus was so great for the cardiovascular system. What's some of the more common or modern day research on that?
So I think one of the, you know, the main mechanism is just that it's super rich in anthocyanins, so as an antioxidants. So if it's, you know, it makes your teas really this bright, beautiful red color, it's so rich in those constituents, and that's how it's protective and healing in the blood vessels and the blood vessel lining to treat things like cholesterol. And then there also is some research showing that it is effective in lowering the blood pressure. So that's another great potential for it. It's often combined. You can get it as a tea with hawthorn often, the name of my practice, hawthorn, another plant that's great for the heart, and which is another kind of red berry, which, again, has these antioxidants, super protective for the heart.
Nice. Now, are there some... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Protection against liver diseases, and I think I saw one study maybe on it being combined with chemo, but more research to be done, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, are there some of the medicinal herbs that you find, like, just unique to Jamaica and the West Indies in your research?
Definitely some foods, things like the ackee, which is a very unique food, kind of a replacement to eggs is one I always think of. But other herbs that are super unique to Jamaica, I would say the noni juice is very common detox. Kind of protocol that can be done with that, and it's very, there's a lot of research coming up on that for anti-cancer and those types of things. And then bitter melon is another one, or sarsi. That's definitely used in other cultures. It's used, you know, in many tropical cultures and Asia and things like that, but the uses are slightly different, or it's used a lot for blood sugar, but in Jamaica they use the leaves as a very strong astringent as well, and as this kind of tonic to clear you out because of its strong, strong bitter astringency. And then they also have the bitter wort, quassia, which is kind of has been rated as one of the strongest bitters in the world, and that's really potent for digestion.
So why are bitters important? So many cultures around the world, you know, where I was in Greece last year and picked up a bottle of bitters when I was in Italy the year before. Bitters. When you were in Switzerland recently, you brought me home a bottle of bitters.
Yeah. I mean, bitters are the classic kind of aperitif, or the little small bit of alcohol that you'll have with a meal to help enhance digestion. So, you know, digestion starts in the mouth with the enzymes in your saliva. So if you can stimulate those enzymes a little bit before your meal, or make sure you're stimulated after your meal, that's going to enhance the whole kind of chain of communication that is digestion. You know, the mouth talks to the stomach enzymes, which talks, you know, down the rest of the chain to the gallbladder, to the liver, to and the whole, you know, colon to get the whole digestive process going. So the bitters help to just kind of jumpstart that. They enhance, you know, they can enhance flavor. There's bitter receptors on almost every organ tissue now. So we see more and more how they affect the system. Even if you don't get that bitter taste, they're really strong tonics and help with tonic in the term here of kind of tonifying a tissue, so helping a tissue do what it does better, whether that's the heart or a muscle or the kidney. And so their bitter receptors help on many tissues, but also for this core digestive one is what we often think of bitters doing.
It turns out a lot of the bitters seem to be pretty anti-inflammatory, which is fascinating. And now we know with, like, you know, golden seal, it helps with lowering the sugar. And it does so through sometimes normalizing gut flora, I think if you absorb better, if you use the bitters regularly and your digestive system is working better, that means your entire body's working better and you're absorbing much, much more of your foods and nutrients and things like that, and that can only enhance health. That's why I found it was interesting that so many cultures use bitters when, as like the first prescription that the doctor gives. You know, they may look at the tongue and say, oh, that tongue looks flabby, it looks too pale, it's too damp, as they say. Now you need bitters, you know, you need to enhance those types of things. So
yeah, and I think it's such a simple way to influence this dynamic ecosystem that is digestion, because you mentioned absorption and all that. I talked about the enzymes and the hormones involved, but then it also is working on the pH, which also is going to then in turn help control and influence the flora, and both with good flora and bad flora, helping to kill things like H. pylori. A lot of those bitter herbs also have effectiveness against that, one, by changing the pH and harmonizing the pH in the stomach, but also in being antimicrobial or antibacterial as well.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that after our break, we'll talk about, you know, how we can apply these bitter herbs, even the tropical bitter herbs, for things like these mosquito-borne illnesses and Lyme disease and things like that. So we're going to go to a break and play one of our natural medicine chests, our syndicated modular program on natural health, and, of course, the name of our book that myself and the natural nurse wrote many years ago, The Natural Medicine Chest. So when we return, we'll talk more about Jamaican herbs, tropical herbs, and how we can use them. Stay with us.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss an herb we all know and love, cinnamon.
Ah, the spicy, sweet smell of cinnamon. Everyone recognizes the familiar aroma of this common kitchen spice. But did you know that cinnamon is an exotic plant bark with a long history of medicinal use in many countries throughout the world? Cinnamon was listed as an herb with medicinal properties in Chinese literature as early as 2700 BC. It is described in the Chinese medical text, the Tang Materia Medica, written in 659 AD. Cinnamon also enjoys traditional use in Ayurvedic medicine, the ancient healing art of India. It is mentioned in the Book of Moses and has been cultivated in Ceylon and Sri Lanka since 1200 AD, where much of the world's supply is still grown.
In Europe, cinnamon was regarded as a rare and precious spice. Many pharmaceutical substances, such as cough syrups and digestive tonics, contain cinnamon. It was also used as an incense and in perfumes. According to Chamberlain, writing in France in 1887, cinnamon possesses the greatest antiseptic properties. Cinnamon is gathered from the dried inner bark of the branches of a small tropical evergreen laurel tree. The bark is peeled off, and as the pieces are dried, they curl up into quills. These are the common cinnamon sticks that are used in herb teas and for baking.
In Chinese medicine, cinnamon is one of the most widely used warming herbs to aid in circulation and digestion. It is a common ingredient in small amounts in tea used for nausea during pregnancy. It is also used following delivery to decrease hemorrhage. Cinnamon raises vitality, warms and stimulates all the vital functions of the body, counteracts congestion, improves the digestive system, relieves abdominal spasms, and aids in peripheral circulation. The essential oils contained in cinnamon include eugenol, cinnamic aldehyde, methyl eugenol, tannins, and mannitol, which give cinnamon its sweet flavor. It also contains cinzenolin and cinzenolol, which are both known insecticides.
Try putting some liquid soap and cinnamon in a spray bottle and use on plants as an organic bug repellent. Cinnamon is also included in many medicinal recipes that are used for lice, scabies, and other skin parasites. Cinnamon has antifungal, antiviral, and bactericidal activities. It has been shown to suppress E. coli, Staphylococcus, and Candida albicans.
So, listeners, the next time you inhale that sweet, spicy aroma, remember, there's more to cinnamon than meets the nose as you reach into your natural medicine chest.
Well, that was real timely, that's for sure.
I know.
Beautiful discussion. Thanks to the engineer for picking that one. Very appropriate for our discussion with Dr. Lindsay here. And by the way, tell us about your website, and I'll give out some information if people want to contact you.
So the best way to contact me is through my practice, Hawthorne Holistic Health. We have a website, hawthornholistichealth.com. We have a Facebook page, those kinds of things. Our EcoTours for Curious group, your wonderful trip that we go down to Jamaica, also has a Facebook page and a website as well, so folks can always check that out and see if it's something that they're interested in participating in and learning about the plants hands-on. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Yeah, thank you. So we were talking about things that are kind of pan-tropical herbs that we find all across the tropics that are used. And what were some of the interesting fruits that were used as medicine that you encountered there? Everything from pineapple. You mentioned that Ethiopian apple. I know that they use, you know, guinep and passion flower, and we use a lot of that in our practice. Talk about some of those other applications.
They also use sour sauce a lot. So sour sauce.
Ah, part of your research.
Raviola sometimes, yeah, anonia. So that one has a ton of more and more research coming out on its effects on being helpful for cancer, being pretty specific for killing different cancer lines while leaving the human cells, you know, healthy. So that's one of the, you know, exciting things that you see in cancer research. You're always looking for targets that kill the bad cells and leave your good cells, or at least don't damage them as much as maybe chemo or other agents. So that's some research that's being done out there. And it is classically used, you know, in Jamaica or by the healers there for the stronger conditions like cancer, and certainly cancer preventative. So they'll do the juice of soursop. It's really delicious. You know, it's this big kind of crazy-looking fruit with all these pointy edges, and then it's soft, it tastes good, but you can also juice it, which is makes a really yummy juice. And then they use the leaves of the soursop as a nervine or as a tonic for the nerves and for calming the nerves, as a anti-anxiety and relaxing tea as well.
That was what you did your thesis on, right, Doctor?
Yeah, that was one of the herbs that I did my thesis on. I did you know, four different herbs that were nervines or were relaxing and good for calming the mind and Jamaican culture. Also, a lot of them are protective for the brain, bring blood flow to the brain, or prevent things like dementia, Alzheimer's, etc.
Now, one of my favorites was, of course, and it's funny, I'm lecturing on this in Burlington in September, on Jamaican herbs that and rainforest herbs, which help with pain, because so many people are addicted to opioids. There are some very powerful natural alternatives to these drugs, including, you know, cannabis and Jamaican dogwood, all of which were introduced to me in Jamaican culture, especially with their applications with pain.
Yeah, the Jamaican dogwood is definitely one of those first herbs that, you know, I really stuck with me after my first year going down there, because, again, I was just so excited to be participating. And you go out, you go on these beautiful hikes, you go and you take something right from the source, and then you go home that night and cook it over fire and get to drink the tea and kind of feel its full effects. So we go on these big hikes, we're all sore, and then we'd use the Jamaican dogwood as a tea combined with other warming spices, pimento, etc., and that really helps relax the muscles, get some of the tightness out, and gets everybody nice and relaxed for a restful sleep before the next day's activities. So I know, I learned it in that sense, and then coming home and researching it, writing small little monographs on it and those kinds of things, developing more of its understanding as a really potent pain medicine, and that one that was used a lot by the eclectic physicians in the 1850s and early 1900s for pain control. You know, it had research showing that it was, or definitely anecdotal research and some, I believe, eclectic research showing that it was as effective as morphine with less of the withdrawal effects. And less of the addictive effects. And it also was used in things like childbirth, really something I'll use a lot with severe menstrual cramps for patients, severe back spasms if the patient throws their back out. You know, it's something that you're using acutely while you're figuring out what else is going on.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually have, you know, Jamba, the Jamaican bush doctor who, you know, I studied with. And actually, you met Jamba too, right? You met him a couple times before he passed on, right?
Yes, that was definitely an important part of the connection down there, and just seeing this vital healer who just had so much wisdom pouring out of him. Quiet, but whatever he said had so much power.
Yeah, a real maroon medicine man, that's for sure.
Definitely.
But one thing he showed me is that you can beat up the Jamaican dogwood bark. And by the way, for those listeners in Florida, you can Jamaican dogwood grows in Florida as well as kind of the more tropical parts of southern Texas, Bahamas, and other places like that. So you can get some of these things, you know, growing in your yard, so to speak. I would certainly, if I lived down in Florida, would get some of these plants going here.
Yeah, but, yeah, it's in the pea family, so it has pretty blooms, too. It's nice.
Oh, yeah. But we would tie it around a sprain. I remember once I strained something, and I remember him beating up the bark and making a poultice, which is unusual. We don't do many poultices in Western medicine. Maybe we do ice as a poultice. Occasionally, we do some other things, you know, maybe icy hot or something like that. But
yeah, it's funny. It's not something that most patients are think to do, or they feel like it's messy, or it's, you know, it's, again, maybe it's not taken as seriously as a medicine, but it can be so powerful to topically just apply that herb right to an area using things like heat to drive it in. Can be really nice to heal acute injuries, and you know you have a great experience with that with different martial arts injuries and those kinds of things too. It's a powerful medicine in Chinese medicine all the time.
Yeah, when I fractured my hand breaking wood in our black belt class, one of the poultices that, you know, of course I, you know, went to the orthopedist, of course, and he checked me out. And yeah, you fractured. You have what's called a boxer's fracture, which is the last, your pinky digit, that part of your hand going from your knuckle to your wrist, that bone just kind of like. So nonetheless, what I did is I slept with poultices. Because Western medicine really didn't offer me anything. They said, okay, you can take Tylenol with codeine. And, you know, one of the things that motivated me, Lindsay, was that the doctor said, you're not going to be able to go on your trip to Jamaica, because I had fractured my hand around Valentine's Day, you know, and we usually go like a month later. And he goes, well, you're not going to be able to use your hand hiking or anything like that. And I said, oh, yes, I am. So I dug deep into my research about how to deal with broken bones and things like that. And I combined comfrey, which, by the way, grows in the West Indies, too. Comfrey is one of those pan herbs that grows everywhere. Comfrey and Jamaican dogwood and turmeric and a couple other poultices. But the idea with the poultice is you actually wrap it around the affliction and you allow the herb to penetrate for a very strong localized effect on that particular area. And so with a fractured bone, you want to, of course, ameliorate swelling, because, you know, swelling's good. It's part of the healing process. But then too much swelling impedes the blood flow of healthy, nutrient-rich blood into the area. So you want to kind of work, balance inflammation is a good way. Mm-hmm. And then you want to deliver, eventually, as the bone starts to get a callus, you want to try to deliver nutrients to that area of healing. I guess that's kind of what poultices are good for. I've used castor oil poultice, you know, castor oil on many afflictions too, and I know that's a big herb down in Jamaica.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love using castor oil with my patients topically. You know, it's good for things like hair, skin, and nails, but it's also good for pain and neuropathies. So that's definitely an herb that we'll use often as the oil and can get patients to use topically. You always want to make sure you tell them that it stains and to put something over it if they're getting into their sheets at night, because it'll make a mess. But if you cover it with another rag or that kind of thing, it's usually pretty good and pretty powerful anti-inflammatory oil.
So that's how you would actually...
down there, it's pretty cool.
That's how you would actually prescribe a castor oil pack? What would you tell folks to do?
So castor oil packs are going to be a little bit different. That's going to be for a shorter period of time where you're using like a hot water bottle, preferably to get some heat over it, over maybe the liver area or lower abdomen, depending what we're working on treating, if it's liver congestion or constipation or if it's more female health issues. But other for pains and things like that, I'll have patients put castor oil on, you know, say it's a knee that's been bothering them or they tweak their knee over the weekend. I'll have them put castor oil on with a very loose kind of wrap on it just so they don't stain their sheets, or, you know, wearing pants or something that's not going to stain. Same with, like, feet or patients who have neuropathies. I've had patients who have been going through, like, chemo and radiation and putting castor oil on the hands and feet every night to prevent some of the neuropathy, which can be a common side effect.
Mm. Now, you mentioned that, you know, it's kind of mosquito season even up here. You know, we tend to go on our, when we're down in our Jamaica trip, the mosquitoes are pretty, they're not too bad at that point, but they, I'm sure they get fierce and ferocious in the rainforest. There are herbs in Jamaica that are used potentially to treat Lyme disease and some of the co-infections here in Connecticut here. So what's been your experience with that?
One thing I'll say first is that using things like the bitters and astringents is something that Lyon and our other guides, John, will say is important. You know, if you have sweet blood, then the mosquitoes and the bugs are going to want to bite you more. So that's one thing that they'll kind of say. Folks who eat too much sugar or whose diet's out of control or those kinds of things, they need those bitter tonics more so, and that can help with preventing the bugs, in their opinion. But also some of the herbs that are used down there that could be applied to some of the co-infections or Lyme would be herbs that are classically used to treat things like syphilis and other infections that mimic Lyme in some ways. So one big example of that is Smilax or the sarsaparilla. And I know that's used in a lot of the different herbal formulations for Lyme blends and those kinds of things. You want it to be in a nice potent extract in order for it to be effective. But it can be a great adjunct therapy as a part of your Lyme protocols.
Anything else? Like, how about, I think the bitter quassia, which you mentioned, the bitterwood, is often used not only as a bitter, but it's actually been used as a treatment for malaria.
So,
a lot of those things are, it's interesting, a lot of those, and look at quinine, you know, I mean, the original, you know, natural medicine for malaria, quinine from the cinchona tree, which does grow in Jamaica. One of the interesting trips that one of these days hopefully we'll make is up into the Blue Mountains. We always go there during the rainy season, so you know, you kind of need a Jeep there, but it's worth actually going up there one of these years. And once years ago, when I was a lot younger, traveling with Jamba around the country, we did get a Jeep and went up into the highlands of Jamaica, way up into the Blue Mountains. You're talking like maybe 8,000 feet or so. And one of the interesting things is that there was an attempt to grow quinine trees in Jamaica, the cinchona trees. And so they named a national park after that. Unfortunately, it failed. It just didn't seem like, even though cinchona is native to Peru and grows up in the highlands of Peru, I think the mountains of Jamaica were a little bit too rainy and just not the exact climate, even though they were trying to emulate it, the British. Why were they doing this? Because before we had alternatives to quinine, that was the treatment for malaria. And the Japanese controlled much of Java, the Philippines, Indonesia, and those areas where, so they basically had a stranglehold on the malaria treatment. And we didn't, you know, there was a race to find the synthetic form, but there was also, they hired a bunch of botanists to also see if they could get quinine to grow in, you know, Jamaica, which was considered a British colony up till the 1960s when Jamaica got its independence. Interesting, huh? How it, history and herbal medicine plays a big role in wartime and discoveries of medicines like the race against time.
Yeah, and how desirable different lands are, too.
Yeah. So, anyway, it didn't work out. So now it's almost like the land of the lost up there. It's like this abandoned botanical gardens. It's probably all overgrown, but I felt like I was, when I went up there, it was like a ghost town, but still so beautiful. Nonetheless, tell us a little bit about...
it's interesting in Jamaica because there's so many different cultures that are a part of the Jamaican history. And so you see all these plants come from different cultures, too. There's lots of plants that are used in Ayurvedic medicine that came from India. There's lots of plants that slaves brought over from Africa, that medicine has been passed down and became a big part of the whole Maroon traditions. So it's a pretty fascinating mix of plants there.
Yeah, and what herbs are being researched for cancer fighting potential. I noticed you mentioned cancer a couple times with the Annona or the soursop. There's a bunch of other ones that are pretty fascinating.
Yeah, so the soursop has, you know, research, like I said, it's chemoprotective, it's anti-cancer, anti-tumor. It has some effect on the dopamine receptors, and so it can be helpful for different neurological conditions. The other one that's getting a good amount of research is the guinea hen weed. So that's one that is a little bit less probably well-known, but getting more and more research. I know, I think it was at the University of West Indies, I believe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but they were doing some research on the guinea hen weed because it has these strong constituents, dibenzyl trisulfides, that are really immunostimulating and being researched for their cancer potential. These are things that, like, that strong smell that the onion family has, garlic has, that open up your sinuses, are some of those constituents.
Yeah, and I know there's a Dr. Williams that's doing some research on that, and he supposedly the drug companies offer him a lot of money, and he turned them down because he feels like it still has a lot of potential for research. But it's like one of those stories where the establishment tries to buy out the practitioner and control the molecule, and it says no. Because there's still a lot more research that has to be done, I'm sure, on the guinea hen weed. But, it's interesting. It's a cousin to poke root, phytolacca, which we use quite a bit for the immune system here. So that's kind of like, it's funny, because when I was down there, I heard about this guinea hen weed, and first of all, I thought it was Guinean, but maybe that's Jamba's thick West Indian accent. I finally keyed it out, and I was like, oh, this is pretty interesting plant. It's in the Phytolaceae family. And so, you know, as botanists and medical botanists and naturopathic doctors, when we hear a family name of a particular group of plants, that often gets us thinking about, other members of that family are extremely strong for, you know, a myriad applications. Maybe this plant has similar applications. Anyway, that was my first kind of thinking with the guinea hen weed, and it turns out that I was correct. This was years ago, even years before Williams did his research. So sometimes that's why knowing the plant family, if those are interested in going into natural medicine and herbalism and things like that, because I know you're part of the American Herbalist Guild. That's important stuff to know the family. And this is why, again, back to our UPS herbalist comment, I think this is so important. You know, if people are disconnected from the real true knowledge of the plants, they're not going to really see the applications. That could be a major discovery, and it sure was for Dr. Williams, for prostate cancer in particular, but many cancers.
Yeah, I always tell students, you know, when they ask about, like, how do you start identifying plants and, you know, telling the difference between different plants, is definitely learning the plant families. That's the easiest way to start to see the patterns and start to say, hey, that looks like a sunflower, or hey, that looks like a rose. And then once you get a few of the, like, more obvious ones down, you get more and more specific with it. And that's how you start to, you know, I describe it as build the different shelves in your bookcase for the plant families and how to identify plants. Because otherwise, you know, a leaf is a leaf. It can be hard to tell just from a picture, you know, on that UPS bottle or box if it's from a tree or from a little weed or if it's from, you know, a big bush or those kinds of things. So knowing where it comes from is just an exciting part of it, too.
And that's the, tell us about the doctrine of signatures and how that would help an herbalist like yourself identify plants and figure out what they're good for.
So the doctrine of signatures is this concept that a plant is going to kind of look like something that it's going to treat. So a classic example is ginkgo biloba has these two lobes in it. The ginkgo leaf looks like a brain, and so it looks, you know, like this thing that it ends up being researched and being so beneficial for in terms of anti-dementia, bringing blood flow to the brain, antioxidant, et cetera. So that's something that we see in all herbal traditions, it's a concept that's kind of expressed, and it's definitely there in Jamaica. You know, some plants, there's one plant, shamalady, or the sensitive plant, which sometimes is sold in greenhouses around here because it's fun. When you touch the leaves, it actually responds, and its leaves close up. They say that it's like a shameful or bashful woman, and it's used a lot to treat anxiety around, like, menstrual periods and those kinds of things. So it's kind of, that's a funny, good example of that. Sometimes, kind of similar to Doctrine of Signatures, you'll look for things like animal modeling. Classic example of, like, a deer that gets hurt goes into cold water to stop the inflammation. In Jamaica, an example of that would be the Ram Goat Dashalong, or the Ram Goat National, the Damiana, which is a kind of adaptogen, sexual tonic, high-energy plant. The Jamaicans say when you see the goats chew on this plant, then they're dashing along and they're all hyper and ready to go. So some of the funnier tonics, too.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I can't believe that an hour has gone by. I'm looking at the time. So we'd like you to finish up with just, again, tell us a little bit about how people could reach you and just maybe a final thought about Jamaican herbs or herbs in general. And thanks so much for donating your time.
So, again, my practice is Hawthorne Holistic Health. I'm right in Hamden, Connecticut, right outside of New Haven. We have Facebook, website, those kinds of things. Eco Tours for Cures Jamaica is the trip that's done with Dr. Z and myself and Dr. Kamai. And a great thing to participate in. We have, you know, pictures and things if you're interested in that. And just for folks to not be afraid to get the herbs into their lifestyle, whether it's cooking with more spices, doing daily teas, using topical applications, taking a bath with a ton of herbs, etc., just getting the herbs in different ways and seeing them as powerful medicines.
Thanks a lot, Dr. Chmielewski. And that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Stay healthy, folks, and use herbs. Bye-bye.